And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We're going to be talking about the environment. Evidently a big talk-a-thon going to be happening this evening. Some 28 Democrats going to be taken to the floor of the Senate, I guess, to have this big talk-a-thon about climate change. Maybe we're going to worry about our environment. Part of me goes, yeah, nice. It's nice to have a little entertainment. But more importantly, we should be talking about the issue, how it is that we end up making sure that we have water, we have food, that we have the things that we need.
You're listening to The Horn, the head-on Radio Network. You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
That the org was to deny the of Latin America.
Thank you.
policy and international foreign policy, which was designed principally to put fallen nations back on their feet, to put Europe back on their feet, to put Asia back on its feet, to put Japan back on its feet after World War II, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And a lot of the context for this, of course, was this hostility and rivalry between the United States and the Soviet Union in the so-called Cold War. And in order to gain advantage in that Cold War, America's decisions, foreign policy decisions, revolved around making sure that our allies were strong. And that meant that we had to rebuild nations that were devastated as a result of the war. And we came up with programs like the Marshall Plan in Europe and military organizations like NATO and CETO and CENTO and METCO, the Middle East Treaty Organization, and all the rest of them. And so there's absolutely no question that rivalry with the Soviet Union in the last half of the 20th century pretty much dictated what we had to do with the nations that were devastated in the first half. All of that is background for what I think is a very, very worthwhile, should be, hopefully, an informative and worthwhile effort to look for the balance of our time together today at the origins of American foreign policy from the late 19th century, from the emergence of the Industrial Revolution in the late 19th century through the 20th century and into the 21st. And the extent to which understanding our foreign policy and the objectives of our foreign policy leads us directly and logically into an understanding and appreciation of the Constitution of the United States itself. And so basically what I'd like to sketch out today, if I can, if I can make it make sense so that it ends up being valuable rather than taking a confusing situation and making it even more so, what I would like to do is suggest, at the beginning at least, an idea of structure and a series of assumptions on which we tend to address problems. International problems, domestic problems, political problems, social problems, economic problems, and all the rest of it. And I think what we begin to see is a pattern. And we see that pattern played out in the Constitutional Convention of 1787. We see it played out in the way America defines its foreign policy needs and interests in the 18th and 19th centuries, and especially as America enters the 20th century under the, in the administration, so-called progressive administrations of Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, and then ultimately in the 1930s, Franklin D. Roosevelt and his New Deal program. I think there's similarity in all of this. I think that these issues tend to be some of the most complex, misunderstood, confusing, frustrating issues for so many people who have gone through so many classes in schools at all levels for so long and had so much trouble trying to make sense out of all of this. I'm hoping that we can come up with a way to connect the dots in such a way that it ends up being rather simplified and rather easy to understand. And if that is successful, then my feeling is all of us, as a result, will have workable tools at our disposal to not only begin to understand some of the issues that are going on in the world of today, but actually to use that understanding as a way to predict the future. One of the things that I find fascinating about history is that when history really begins to make some sense to folks, we begin to realize the benefits of history for its predictive value. People don't change from one generation to the next. oh, they change. The situation changes. The definition of the problems they have to face change. And sometimes people have to resort to their own creative methods in order to come up with new ways to address new challenges and those kinds of things. We know all that. But the fact of the matter is there are certain basic things that don't change. People remain the same. People's objectives pretty much remain the same. Much of the political controversy and ideological debate and difficulties that we experience in the modern world today usually don't revolve so much around ends as about means. Most people, whatever their political persuasion, most people want the same things for themselves and for their families and for their children and for their grandchildren. And the irony is, especially if you stick within the developed world itself, what you find is that people in Europe and the Far East, that people are people. They expect certain things, they want certain things, they look to government for certain things, they like to believe that they can trust in their own abilities and their own talents to provide certain things. So usually, what we find is that people tend pretty much to agree on what they want out of life, what they'd like to see happen. Where the trouble comes, where the debate comes, is how best to get there. And we have a number of people who, over time, who have come up with their own formula, their own individualized formula for getting to where they would most likely like to go. A lot of it revolves around government. And the debate tends to focus on to what extent does government serve as an asset to achieve the kinds of things we want to achieve? When does government become an obstacle rather than an asset? And what do we need to do about government that turns it into a positive rather than risk it becoming a negative? And so you have some people who believe that government needs to be big and powerful and wealthy, because where we end up is pretty much going to depend on where government can take us. And then we have the exact opposite of that, which is the idea that government is the biggest obstacle to individual and its people's ability to exercise their own freedoms and their own talents that promises the greatest good for the greatest number. And in order to allow that to work, government has to get out of the way. And so consequently, what these people, today we call them conservatives, what these people would basically argue is that whatever we look to government to do, you can be pretty sure that the private sector can do it better, more cheaply, and more efficiently. And if that becomes your ideological position, then you have a vested interest of doing everything you can do to demean the ability to government, the ability of government to compete with that point of view. In other words, the more faults and wrongs you can find in government behavior, the stronger and more solid your case seems to become. And the same thing happens on the other side. I think we see this now with the debate over the Affordable Care Act, President Obama's health care program, where this has obviously become his signature program. And we have an awful lot of money going into advertising to convince the American people that the Affordable Care Act can't work, doesn't work, is creating more problems than it causes, is potentially going to destroy the best healthcare system in the world, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then on the other hand, we have the reality that the Affordable Care Act, for the first time, promises to be able to deliver the kind of health insurance that's going to enable 45 to 50 million people who had no chance in the world of getting health care now are going to have access to health care. And those who advocate this position in support of the Affordable Care Act argue that once people can rest assured and feel secure in the fact that they have health care and that they don't have to worry about being economically destroyed and losing their homes and their bank accounts and their entire future through one or two medical disasters, once people can rest assured that the health care issue is taken care of, then they can afford to concentrate on skills and securing jobs and moving ahead. Because the burden of health care, I can't afford to change jobs because I can't afford to lose my health care. Or I can't afford to take a job at all because right now under the CHIP program, my children have health care. And if I take a job and start earning an income, I'll lose access to CHIP and my kids will lose their health care. I can't risk that because chances are the job I'm going to get is not going to pay that much anyway. So consequently, my accepting a job is going to come at a cost much greater than the benefits of the job itself. And so we find that, you know, many people find that the promise of the Affordable Care Act is in many ways a key that will unleash economic development in this country like nothing else has promised to do so in a long time. So we have two different camps. One putting the faith for America's future in the Affordable Care Act, the other suggesting that America's future is doomed with the Affordable Care Act. And chances are, and I'm using the media news reports to verify this, but chances are most people find this very confusing and really aren't sure what the proper answer is. And so it becomes a very, very complex and a very disturbing issue to a lot of people. So it seems to me then that what we've got to do is try to find keys or issues that seem to link things together that don't necessarily seem connected. And if we can do that, sometimes the very complex turn out to be rather simple. Not simple, but simplified, let's say. And much easier to understand. And once we get there, then it seems to me decision-making for ourselves as well as recommended decisions the country ought to make become a lot easier. So with that, I'd like to maybe go back a little bit to the American Revolution and start looking at the structure of government, the idea of the nature of the republic. We've talked about a lot of this before, so much of this will be old stuff. But maybe this is a different context. We will remember that during the Revolution, when the founders began to speculate on the kind of government that would follow independence once the war for independence was won, and of course, you know, there was basically the assumption that indeed it would be successful and America's independence would be secured. And those, if you read military historians, you begin to realize that there were real serious questions as to whether, in fact, that was going to happen at all. Many military people have looked at Washington and the ragtag army that Washington had and the lack of resources and the lack of support and the lack of finances and all the rest of it. And sometimes they just throw up their hands and say, how in the name of heavens did we ever win this war against the greatest military power on the face of the earth at that time? But we did it. And so during the course of the war, the founders began to speculate. Debates would occur during the Continental Congresses, the Second Continental Congress especially, about the nature of political government, the nature of the kind of system that we wanted to set up, And, of course, all of that speculation and all of that thinking came to a head in Jefferson's Declaration. Because in his effort to make the case to the world about the right of the American colonies to be independent from the mother country, Jefferson included a vital paragraph toward the front end of the Declaration which laid out the philosophical basis for republicanism in America. This is what Americans believe government and the citizens who live under that government ought to be all about. And this is what we want to come out of this military effort. And that is the establishment in America of republican government. And the thinking was, for reasons that we've talked about in the past, going to the source, so to speak, which was Montesquieu and Montesquieu's Spirit of the Laws, the basis of republican government. And the very principle of republican government, which was kind of a given, given the priorities that Jefferson laid out in the Declaration, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by the Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are the rights to life, liberty, and property. In order to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. And whenever government violates these principles, in other words, violates the so-called social contract upon which government is founded between government, the entity, and the people of America, whenever that contract between people and government is violated, and of course the assumption is that it would be government that will violate it, not the people, then the people have not just the right, they have the duty to abolish that government because it has, in a sense, violated a contract. It has delegitimized itself and rendered itself unworthy of being continued. So consequently, the people have a duty to get rid of that government and to set up a new government that will abide by the social contract. And the social contract between government and its people is based on a government whose powers are limited to the protection and the guarantees of the inalienable rights listed in the Declaration. The rights to life, liberty, and property, and a clear recognition that all men are created equal. And I've made the point in the past, and I've just made reference to it here. It seems to me very, very significant that the idea of equality to Jefferson comes even before the inalienable rights of individuals to life, liberty, and property. I would suggest that the issue of equality is extremely important to Jefferson. And if you jump ahead a number of years to 1789, and you look at the Constitution created in France as part of the French Revolution, the French Constitution, if you will, a declaration of rights of the citizen, of man and citizen in France. Jefferson contributes significantly to that in his work with Lafayette in drafting the Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen in France. And in that document, Jefferson elaborates on the issue of equality. And one must conclude that while he was being very, very brief and concise in the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson's intent in America in 1776 was to introduce the idea of equality into society, as he did 13 years later in France, with a much more elaborate explanation of the significance and the role of equality in society. Those that debate and question how important equality was to Jefferson, because he didn't really put a lot of time into it, he just mentioned that all people were created, that all men were created equal. I said all people, of course. And women have made it a point to suggest that at the time Jefferson wrote this, it was all men. But the fact that he gave very little verbiage to the idea of equality has caused a lot of people to suggest that the inalienable rights to life and liberty and the opportunities that liberty presented to people to acquire property ought to take precedence over the equality issue. I think Jefferson, in the Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen in France, makes it very clear that that's a very, very dangerous step to take, namely to downplay or to diminish the emphasis that Jefferson wanted to place on equality. I think in the Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen in France, Jefferson makes very clear that equality is an important part of the total equation. I think that that's a very, very significant point, but very honestly, a lot of people who have a vested interest in emphasizing liberty in order to tie it to free enterprise capitalism later on are not inclined to go to France and look where Jefferson said something quite a bit differently. So there may be political assumptions and priorities associated with this debate. But the point is that the philosophy of government laid out by Jefferson in the Declaration is very consistent with the idea of republican government as defined and explained by Montesquieu in his Spirit of the Laws. And the key factor in all of this is the size of government. A republic, by definition, is a popular government. And what Montesquieu lays out very clearly is that in order for republican government to work, there must be an ongoing, consistent, smooth interaction and interrelationship between people and those they elect to represent them in government. In order that the representatives can accurately reflect the will of the people that they represent. If you are going to be elected as a representative and you are going to be charged with representing the best interests of the people in your constituency, then Montesquieu's argument is it is very, very important that you know your constituents. You know what their needs are, what their wants are, what their challenges are, what their hopes are, so that you can bring this to the legislative chamber and make sure that it is seriously considered when legislation is being considered. So consequently, the Articles of Confederation government set up during the war, the Articles of Confederation were written in 1776, 1777, although they were not approved until 1781, primarily because one state, Maryland, refused to go along with the Articles until the previous colonies, the states that controlled large amounts of western land, specifically Virginia, which of course is right across the Potomac River from Maryland, until Virginia was willing to sacrifice its western lands to the Union by turning control over its western lands to the Congress. Only when Virginia agreed to do that would Maryland agree to abide by or to adopt the Articles of Confederation. And the way the Articles of Confederation were written, in order to become effective, all states had to agree. It had to be unanimous. And so Maryland was able to block ratification of the Articles for better than 3 years, holding out until Virginia finally was forced to concede control of its western lands to Congress in order to get the Articles approved. The Articles of Confederation created a relationship between central government and states in which the states would have the bulk of the sovereignty, the bulk of the power. The only powers granted to the central government were those powers that representatives of these states believed the central government had to have in order to hold the Union together and function, mainly to win a war. But there was tremendous fear of the power of central government. So consequently, the representatives in the Congress made very, very sure that the powers of the central government were limited to the point that the second article of the Articles of Confederation said very clearly that all powers not granted specifically to the central government, expressly is the word they use, all powers not expressly granted to the central government are reserved to the state and to the people of the states. The inclusion of the word expressly meant that unless a specific grant of power to the central government could be pinpointed in the document, it remained a power reserved to the states. Consequently, the states made very, very sure that the central government would have to remain dependent on the states. The belief was the way you can check the power of the central government is to make sure that the central government remains dependent on the states for what it needs, specifically revenue and troops. The central government was denied the power to tax. The states were granted the power to tax in their own state constitutions. So if the central government needed revenue, its only recourse was to ask the states for it. The thinking being that by keeping the central government dependent on the states for revenue, the states would forever be sure that the central government would remain under their control. A second major power denied to the central government under the Articles was the power to regulate trade. Most people realize that a central government in a union must have the ability to regulate commerce and trade. But the architects of the Articles of Confederation made sure that Congress's ability to regulate trade did not involve or did not include the right to generate revenue from that trade. Whatever revenue was generated by commerce went to the states, not to the central government. Again, making sure that the central government was kept dependent upon the states. And then thirdly, the central government was denied the power to raise an army. the only way that the central government could secure an army was to request contributions of troops from the individual states. And the understanding and explanation for this goes all the way back to the British occupation of Boston in the 1770s. The founders saw clearly what happens when you have a standing army. That army will inevitably be used against its own people. So America went through and came out of its war for independence with a firm commitment to prevent there from ever being a standing army in America. If you want to keep the central government weak, you better deny it the opportunity to have its own army. Because once you give a central government its own army, the central government can no longer be kept weak. And consequently, it will inevitably use its control over military power against the states and against the people of the states. So it's not until 10 years into the history of the nation under the Constitution, it's not until the 1790s that the United States begins to shift its position on the idea of a standing army and begins to recognize that if this nation is going to be taken seriously in the world of nations, it must have the military capability of backing up its positions. It must have an army. The issue that really promotes or prompts the transition from opposition to a standing army to, I would say, a reluctant acceptance of the need for a standing army is the Indian situation in the West. In order to open up the West, the lands of the West, to settlement, it becomes very clear in the 90s that federal troops are going to have to go out there and pacify the Indian population, secure peace and stability, if you expect settlers to go out there and conquer the West. So increasingly, the need for a standing army in order to stabilize the West and open it up for settlement becomes a dominant feature in the transition from opposition to a standing army to reluctant approval of one. The individual person, the individual founder most responsible for that is Alexander Hamilton. Alexander Hamilton wanted a standing army from the very beginning, and he was looking for ways to make the case. And the Indian situation in the West became for him an optimum opportunity to sell the idea of a standing army. And you may remember the famous Battle of Tippecanoe in 1811. Tippecanoe and Tyler too, if you remember that. Harrison. That victory of Fallen Timbers and the victory at Tippecanoe is the final defeat of the Indians, and it opens up the Northwest, at that time the Northwest Territory, which is Indiana, Illinois, Wisconsin, Michigan. That at that time it was the West. So consequently, under the Articles of Confederation, the central government is kept weak and dependent on the states by denying the states, by denying the central government an independent source of revenue and an independent source of troops. Without getting into a tangent here, I just want to say that this is one of the one of the issues, I think, in American foreign policy in recent years that has pretty much come in under the radar, so to speak. And that is the extent to which America's army is an all-volunteer army. You remember the argument, the Vietnam War was the last war in which the draft was prevalent, in which we began to draft men, young men. And out of the Vietnam's debacle situation comes this idea that what America ought to have is a volunteer army. But what we have seen in the last 35 to 40 years is what government can do or not do when it has access to its own private army. It can engage in so-called limited wars and pretty much fly under the radar of oversight from the American people, because so much of America's military activity in the world is relatively invisible to the general population. When there's a draft and people's own sons and daughters are being required to go and fight and die for this nation, everybody knows what's going on. In other words, we have an educated, involved citizenry who's very involved in oversight as far as foreign policy, because it directly affects every American family. But when you eliminate the draft and you replace it with a standing army, the only citizens who have a direct interest in what our foreign adventures might end up being, be it Afghanistan, be it Iraq, be it any number of interventions in Latin America and other places, the only people that have a vested interest are the families of those who are in the military. So consequently, government is able to operate with much more flexibility and much greater freedom and maneuverability, because it is not responsible to the public at large. Most people don't care. And so I think more than anything else, the adventures that America has gotten itself into foreign policy-wise with the transition from the draft to an all-volunteer army, I think more than anything else it reinforces the founders' fear and suspicion of a standing army. I think the behavior of George Bush and Dick Cheney and some of those people, neocons and all the rest of it, that are so inclined for America to intervene militarily, the pressure that's being put on the president right now in terms of the Ukraine, those that want to basically lead with the sword, those who believe that negotiation is a mark of weakness rather than strength, these people pretty much were given their head with the transition from the draft that existed during the Vietnam situation to the all-volunteer army that came in after that. So I think that there's quite a bit of verification and validity here for the concerns and the fears of the founders related to the idea of a standing army. I think it's very important to recognize the role that Alexander Hamilton played, along with George Washington, in the development of West Point. West Point was created in order to create an officer corps for a standing army that 10 years earlier did not exist and could not exist because the American people would never support it. But they ended up supporting it. So we have reached the top of our first hour, and we have pretty much gone through the Confederation period. What I'd like to do when we come back is look at the Constitution of the United States, and then once we look at that structure, we can move into contemporary American foreign policy and begin to look and make some, hopefully, some connections that'll make some sense. You're listening to the Virtual Center for the Study of the U.S. Constitution and Civic Responsibility. I'm Bill O'Brien. It's 2 minutes after the hour. After a five-minute break, we'll be right back. Please stay with us.
The Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility with your host, Dr. Bill O'Brien.
Thank you, Bob Kincaid, and welcome back to our second hour here at the Virtual Center. It's 7 minutes after the hour. And if you are with us and have been with us through our entire program today, we thank you for staying with us. If you are just joining us, welcome. We're kind of walking our way through American history a little bit today. But we're headed to an objective. I hope at the end of the program, we'll reach a destination which will hopefully bring a lot of this into perspective and hopefully justify the fact that it makes some sense. At least I hope so. But that's my challenge is to make that happen. I would love to hear from you on some of these issues. We're going to be talking about American foreign policy, especially, focused on the 20th century. And we would love to hear from you. Our phone number is area code 304-658-3333. That's 304-658-3333. My email address, if you'd like to communicate with me directly on any of these issues, Just send your email to waobrien906@gmail.com. That's waobrien906@gmail.com. We've been looking at the origins of American foreign policy and the idea of the optimum relationship in the thinking of the founders between government and the people in this form of government that we call a republic. And the general thinking going all the way back to the sources, to principally Montesquieu, the idea is that in order for republican government to work, it had to be small. And the reason it had to be small is so that there could be an ongoing reciprocal relationship between those elected to represent the people and the people themselves. And so consequently, it was necessary to make sure that power resided at the state level rather than at the national level. In other words, the whole structure of government set up under the Articles of Confederation was based on the republican model laid out by Montesquieu, that in order for popular government to work, power had to be in the local area so that the reciprocal relationship between people and elected representatives could make decisions that were indeed in the public interest. The fear is if you put too much power on the national level, you create a national constituency and you create a multiplicity of competing interest groups. And the sum total of a competing number of groups seeking government's favor, the result of that is the ultimate decision resides in the hands of government, not the people. In a sense, then, by removing power from the state level to the central government, you are literally altering who makes decisions. The people through their representatives, or the representatives justifying their decisions to the people. And that difference is, for our purposes today at least, the principal issue associated with the ratification of the Constitution. Those who advocated the need, pushed for the need for a strong central government, did so because they wanted this very change to take place. Decision-making power, the Federalists believed, had to be in the hands of the people most qualified to make those decisions. The aristocracy, the upper class, whatever you wanted to call it, the best educated. And so consequently, you had to find a way to take power out of the states, and the transition created by the Constitution of the United States was able to do that. And as we've pointed out in previous programs, all of that was done under the cover of the label of republican government. In other words, Federalists continue to maintain that they really weren't doing anything with ratification of the Constitution to change the nature of republican government. But in fact, they were. Because the people who made the decisions changed. Power flowed from the people of each independent republic, states, to elected officials sitting at the national level, who, because of the nature of the way power was dispersed, ended up defining the public interest for the people rather than looking to the people to define the public interest for themselves. But the Federalists were very, very adamant in denying the full implications of that change. They insisted that we still maintained a republican government, because people could elect representatives and could vote. In other words, what really changed here was a much more limited, restricted, defined definition of the term Republican. A republic now involved the process of holding elections and giving people the right to vote. That in and of itself made a republic, once the Constitution was adopted. The shift in who made decisions, as laid out in Madison's Federalist No. 10, is pretty much denied until after the Constitution is ratified. And then increasingly, the Supreme Court adopts the role of interpreting the Constitution in such a way that it is able to make determinations in specific cases. In this case, the federal government has the power. In this case, the state retains the power, et cetera, et cetera. That's pretty much what the Supreme Court ends up doing in the plethora of Supreme Court cases that come before it under the Constitution of the United States. And, of course, that then becomes the mechanism whereby the nation develops through the 19th century, and of course it has to work out the struggles between North and South, the slave system and the free labor system, and we ultimately have the Civil War, etc., etc. And then in the late 19th century, once the Civil War is over, the full thrust of the Industrial Revolution that has been underway in Europe throughout much of the 19th century, the full power of the Industrial Revolution hits America. Once the Civil War is over, and once the Union is reconstructed, and once the relationship between the South and the rest of the Union is worked out, the nation is then able to undertake the kind of economic expansion and growth that takes America from the end of the war in 1865 as an emergent industrial nation to its status at the turn of the century in 1900 as one of the major industrial powers in the world, along with Great Britain, along with Prussia, and to a lesser degree, Italy and some of the other nations of developed Europe. And no sooner, you know, as I say, 14 years into the 20th century, 1914, World War I breaks out in the continent of Europe. And for several years, from 14 to 1917, the United States is able to remain aloof from, outside, the war. As President Woodrow Wilson is proclaiming America's neutrality in that war. When, in fact, if you look at the behavior of the United States government, we are not neutral at all, if you define neutral as treating both sides in the struggle the same. America begins to loan munitions, weapons, and money to the Allies at a rate that is incredibly unbalanced compared to the treatment given Germany, Austria-Hungary, and the so-called Central Powers. And when challenged on this very unique definition of neutrality, President Wilson's justification for our behavior was that part of the responsibility of a neutral is to be able to do business with everybody, whether they're involved in war or not, as if, as far as we're concerned, there's no war going on at all. And in order to maintain our neutrality, we have to do whatever we can to make sure that the competing sides in the conflict are relatively balanced. And since, Wilson went on, since we know that Germany, Prussia, is so much better armed, militarily and financially equipped than are the Allies, then it is in supplying the aid that we are giving to the Allies that creates the balance that is necessary for recognition of America's neutrality. Now, if that sounds confusing, I would suggest to you it is intended to be confusing. It is one of the most unbelievable definitions of neutrality that one can imagine. In order to have our neutrality recognized by all parties in the conflict, what we have to do is use our resources appropriately in order to create relative balance in the sides. And since one side is overwhelmingly advantaged as opposed to the other, then the real neutral thing that we can do and are doing is to feed support to the weaker side in order to bring it up to relative balance with the other side, thereby ensuring that both sides will more likely respect America's neutrality. It's a fantastic definition if you think about it. But let's go back a little bit into the late 19th century and the Industrial Revolution, more specifically on the impact that the Industrial Revolution has on America's role in the world. Not its military role, but its commercial role. We have talked about this before, and I don't think it's necessary to spend a lot of time on it. Amongst the changes that the Industrial Revolution produces in America, changes in our cities, changes in working conditions, changes in the relative structure of our families, the demographic change, which causes a lot of people to relocate from rural America to urban America because urban America is where the jobs are. As a result of the Industrial Revolution, America ceases to be a rural nation and becomes an urban nation. And the vast bulk of its population is urban rather than rural. And that necessitates an awful lot of change in the role of the government and the way that the public interest, so-called, is defined. So the history of the 20th century, by definition, must change, given the demographic changes generated by the Industrial Revolution within America. But in terms of America's role in the world, the Industrial Revolution creates changes in that area as well. To be succinct about it, to be as concise as I can, the Industrial Revolution revolutionizes contemporary attitudes towards trade, towards commerce. Because as never before in American history, the Industrial Revolution has made it possible for America to outproduce its own ability to consume. The Industrial Revolution and the application of science to manufacturing, as well as to agriculture, means that the United States is capable of producing more in agriculture and more industrial products than the American population can buy. Consequently, the strength and viability of the nation's economy becomes directly connected to our overseas success in securing not only additional markets, but also additional sources of raw materials that our industrial capability demands. We must expand. We must find new markets in order to sell what we produce on the farm and in the factory. Because if we don't, warehouses will become overstocked. Employers, businesses will no longer have the need to manufacture because none of the stuff is selling. So consequently, they will have no option except to begin to reduce the hours of work and lay off employees. Translation: a successful foreign policy is directly related to a strong domestic policy. America's economy is only as strong as is its ability to find overseas markets as well as sources of raw materials. We need coal, we need iron, we need timber, we need oil, we need all of the things, magnesium and rubber and on and on and on. And depending on the product, it drives us into Africa, it drives us into Latin America, it drives us into Asia. And so by definition, the Industrial Revolution, as nothing before it, has caused America to reconstruct and reconfigure its whole approach toward international policy, foreign policy. It doesn't mean that expansion is new at the turn of the century. That's not what I'm saying at all. America has always been an expansive nation. The difference is that throughout much of its history, up until the end of the 19th century, that expansion was continental expansion. We were moving from one coast to the other. We were settling a continent. And so all of the sociological concepts associated with expansion were in place. The idea of a second chance, the idea of picking oneself up if you fail and moving on and starting all over again because there was seemingly unlimited opportunity out there because there was so much land available. All of the things that made America an expansive nation, all of those things that contributed to the American attitude and value system of hard work and opportunity and success and the acquisition of property and limited government's responsibility to protect your freedom, to secure success, and to protect the results of that success. In other words, to protect your property by considering private property as sanctified, the sanctity of private property. All of those things were part of the American experience before the Industrial Revolution. The difference was the Industrial Revolution basically put America's expansion on steroids. No longer was continental domestic expansion enough to generate the kind of consumer market that was necessary to support America's manufacturing capabilities, both industrially and agriculturally. While so many rural people are moving to the cities because that's where the jobs are, the fact of the matter is American agriculture is industrializing as well. Consequently, American farmers are producing as much or even more than they ever produced before with substantially fewer human hands to work the lands. Technology is eliminating jobs in rural America, but industrialism is creating jobs in urban America. So the United States experiences this tremendous demographic shift in population. But increasingly, it becomes clear that only overseas success is going to continue to support and feed the productivity, the production capabilities generated in the United States by the Industrial Revolution. And then in the late 19th century, a situation emerges in Cuba. A guerrilla movement, a nationalist movement of Cubans to secure their independence from Spain, begins in the 1890s, actually began earlier than the 1890s, but it comes to a head in the 1890s. And Spain undertakes, makes policy decisions to crush this rebellion in Cuba, right 90 miles off the coast of Florida, which creates serious consternation within the United States. And there's tremendous pressure on the government of the United States to intervene in support of the Cuban revolutionaries, in support of Cuban independence from Spain. Many people make the analogy and the comparison between this and America's own movement for independence. Many people see in the Cuban independence movement yet another unfolding of the American Revolution with the same values of Republican government associated with it. Freedom, independence, the right to vote, etc., etc., etc. And through a series of efforts, including the explosion on the battleship Maine and all the rest of it, the decision is made to intervene in Cuba and go to war with Spain. But lo and behold, Assistant Secretary of the Navy at the time, Theodore Roosevelt, sends word to Admiral Dewey, who's in command of the Pacific Fleet, telling him that in the event that Congress declares war on Spain, Dewey is immediately to sail into Manila Harbor and seize control of the Philippines, which belonged to Spain. And so, in a sense, the first blow of the Spanish-American War doesn't happen in Cuba at all. It happens in the Pacific. And that has led many historians to argue that the Cuban situation was merely a cover for America's desire to seize the Philippines in order to have much more immediate access to the burgeoning market in China, because America's industrial capability demanded that we secure access to the China market. And at that time, it was seen as vital that in order to have a viable shot at commercial success in the Orient, it was necessary to have coaling stations strategically located throughout the Pacific, so that America could become a viable competitor in the emerging China market. By the time the Spanish-American War has occurred, by the late 1890s, most industrialized nations of the world have begun to realize that the 20th century success of their economies is going to be directly dependent on their success in accessing the China market, the potential consumer market that exists in China because of the size of the population there. And so consequently, beginning in the middle 19th century, European nations are jockeying for advantage, trying to secure a foothold in China. Many of you will remember from your history books in the 1840s something called the Opium Wars in China, where Great Britain is able to conquer Chinese opposition and gain from the Chinese government commercial advantages in China. What Great Britain is after is a foothold. And through the Opium Wars and some of these events in the middle of the 19th century, first Great Britain and then Germany and then other nations as well, including Japan, interestingly enough, whereas China resists Western development, Japan embraces it. And Japan joins the West in its effort to secure commercial advantage in China. And so the reality is, by the time the United States is engaged in debate over whether we should adopt or embrace or welcome Hawaii, the Philippines into the United States, this big debate is going on as to whether the United States is violating every one of its principles as stated in the Declaration by the founders by colonizing the Philippines. In other words, how absolutely hypocritical it would be for the United States to come into existence because of its claimed right to be free from a colonial power, and then to turn around and become a colonial power in its own right by colonizing the Philippines. So a big debate breaks out in America over whether access to the China market should be the most dominant consideration, or whether the heritage and the value system derived from the American Revolution ought to take precedence. While that debate is going on, a distinct commercial reality about China begins to take shape. By the end of the 19th century, 1898-1899, the major industrial powers of the world, except the United States, have been able to secure what are called spheres of influence in China. Areas of China which are recognized as being the British sector, the French sector, the Italian sector, the German sector, the Japanese sector. But there's no American sector. It looks like if something isn't done to find a way to gain access to the China market for the United States, we're going to be shut out of China before the debate over whether we ought to colonize the Philippines or not is even resolved. And at that point, in 1898, America's Secretary of State, John Hay, drafts a series of notes to each of the industrial powers with a sphere of influence in China. England, France, Italy, Japan, and Russia. John Hay sends the so-called open door notes to every one of these powers. And in these notes, John Hay makes an appeal for the adoption of the free market, the open door. This is the introduction to his notes. You can get this on the internet. Just look at open door notes under Google, and you can print this off for yourself. By the late 19th century, Japan and the European powers had carved much of China into separate spheres of influence inside of which each held economic dominance. The United States, coming late into imperialism, held no sphere of influence in China. In 1899, United States Secretary of State John Hay proposed an open-door policy in China in which all nations would have equal trading and development rights throughout all of China. In other words, the United States was not asking for a sphere of influence. What the United States was asking for is the right to do business within everybody else's sphere of influence. Asking each nation to concede America commercial access to its sphere. This is exactly what John Jay said in his notes. Earnestly desirous to remove any cause of irritation and to ensure at the same time the commerce of all nations in China, the United States urges all nations claiming a sphere of influence in China to declare that all nations shall enjoy perfect equality of treatment for their commerce and navigation within such spheres, within its respective sphere of influence. First, now these are the three parts to the notes. First, will in no way interfere with any treaty or port or any vested interest of another nation within its own sphere of influence in China. In other words, the United States will not interfere in any way with the political realities of the sphere of nations, the sphere of influence. All we want is the right to play, to do business. We will accept the fact that it's your sphere. We're not challenging your right to a sphere of influence there. We're only requesting permission to do business there. In other words, you can put the fence around the playground. All we want is the right to play in it. Second, that the Chinese tariff, the amount of revenue that the Chinese government gets from the trade that European nations derive from the China market, the Chinese tariff shall apply to all merchandise landed or shipped to all such ports within said sphere of influence, no matter what nationality it may belong to, and that duties so leviable shall be collected by the Chinese government. This is important. The key to this whole policy is the preservation of the entity of China. What Hay worries more about than anything else is that the Chinese government remain viable, so viable that it's collecting tolls, tariffs, from the business, the commerce that's happening within every sphere of influence. In other words, the Chinese government gets a cut of all the business that happens in everybody's sphere. That way, China remains viable. Because the reality is that only so long as China remains viable can the spheres of influence work. If China ever reaches the point where it's no longer a viable government, if China ever reaches the point where the Chinese government falls, then the whole system falls apart, because each European nation then will feel committed to wall off its sphere of influence, to turn its sphere into a colony. And if Germany and France and Great Britain and Italy and Russia and Japan all colonize pieces of China, then there'll be nothing left for us. So the only way that we can win in this is if spheres of influence are preserved. And the only way that they can be preserved is if each nation recognizes the importance of keeping the Chinese government in business. clearly the Chinese government is seen as a puppet of the European powers. But it's a very important puppet, because it keeps control of the Chinese people. It secures stability and order while we do business. Therefore, it becomes vital. And so the third point in John Hay's open door note, that a nation will levy no higher harbor duties on vessels of another nationality frequenting any port in such sphere that shall be levied on vessels of its own nationality, and no higher railroad charges over lines within its sphere on merchandise belonging to citizens or subjects of other nationalities. In other words, within China, there's going to be free trade back and forth from one sphere to the other, whether it be commercial through ships or whether it be on land with railroads. What we're looking for is a viable, growing economy where everybody's going back and forth with no restrictions, no borders, no limitations, no tariff protections where you have to pay extra tariffs to do business here. What we want is open trade, free trade, within the spheres of influence, everybody paying a just tariff to the Chinese government. And that way, we are buying from the Chinese government the right to exploit China to our own capabilities. We can compete with each other in terms of our own commercial advantage. Everybody has equal opportunity to do business there. So then John Hay brings the notes to a conclusion. The United States seeks the adoption of measures ensuring the benefits of equality of treatment of all foreign trade throughout China. Everybody will be treated equally. There'll be free trade. We adhere to the policy of peace with the Chinese nation, of furtherance of lawful commerce, and of protection of lives and property of our citizens by all means. We are committed to affording all possible protection everywhere in China to American life and property, guarding and protecting all legitimate American interests, and aiding to prevent a spread of disorders in China. Should there ever be a disorder in China, should there ever be a revolutionary movement to topple the government of China because the people of China begin to see that it's a puppet of the West, then the policy of the government of the United States is to seek a solution which may bring about permanent safety and peace to China, preserve Chinese territorial and administrative entity, protect all rights guaranteed to friendly powers by treaty and international law, and safeguard for the world the principle of equal impartial trade with all parts of the Chinese Empire. In other words, if there's ever a movement to topple the Chinese government, which would be against all of our interests, then we will all pool our interests militarily, and we will assist the Chinese government and keep it in power. Because only so long as it remains viable, are we viable in China. And John Hay sends this letter to every one of the major powers with a sphere of influence in China, and asks them to accept the principle of the open door. Now put yourself in the position of the European nations. Why should I? And what response Hay gets, most of them will come back with a response something like, well, I'm not really sure that this is in our interest, but if everybody else does it, we'll do it. Once John Hay receives three or four responses like that, he announces to all the major powers that they have all agreed, and that now the nations have agreed to the principle of the open door in China. That's in 1899. No sooner is there agreement on the open door policy in China by the major powers than a rebellion breaks out against the Chinese government, which history knows as the Boxer Rebellion. There used to be a movie. It was in Technicolor in the 1950s called 55 Days at Peking, starring Burt Lancaster. All the years I was growing up in the 50s, I thought Burt Lancaster by himself put down the boxers. But what the West does is to create a unified joint army of 25,000 men. The United States contributes, I believe, 7,000 to an international force to put down the boxers. That seems to me to be incredibly important and revealing, because it really gives us some insight into what the open door policy is all about. All of it is contingent on keeping China in power, keeping the Chinese government in power. Because as long as it's in power, we can do business. Our tariffs help it stay in power. We all have a vested interest in helping China to make sure that China remains secure and stable and is able to put down rebellions like the Boxer Rebellion. No sooner is the Boxer Rebellion successfully crushed by the major powers working together than John Hay recognizes in 1900 that in retaliation against the violence of the Boxer Rebellion, there's a distinct possibility that each major nation in China will colonize its sphere. In other words, the one thing we don't want is for the nations of Europe to overreact and try to secure the borders of their sphere of influence to the point that the principle of the open door is violated. So John Hay takes up his pen and sends a second set of open door notes to the major powers, in which he asks them to reconfirm their commitment to the principle of the open door, and this is important, and to the territorial integrity of China. One of the most famous foreign policy historians in American history, William Appleman Williams, in his very famous book, The Tragedy of American Diplomacy, made the point that if one understands the open door policy as it evolved in China, one can understand everything that has always driven American foreign policy, and one can understand everything that will continue to govern American foreign policy decisions into the future. If you understand the open door, the concept, the principles behind it, you will be able to predict every single policy decision that the United States will make in foreign policy for the foreseeable future, because all of it is driven by the principle of the open door. America's success in the world is directly dependent upon the extent to which the world is potentially America's market. America's continued growth, industrially and materially, the only way that its economy can continue to grow and expand and create additional opportunities for new citizens, is that America not be limited or restricted from any place in the world as a potential place to do business. If we can get the major nations of the world to buy into this concept, to commit to the idea of free trade, we will have a world which has a vested interest in securing peace. There'll be no advantage to going to war. Everybody has a vested interest in the preservation of this system. And of course, the unwritten part of this is that the United States believes that because of the wealth and raw materials that the United States, the continental United States, is blessed with, plus the realities of coaling stations around the world, in a free and open trade situation throughout the world, the United States has every opportunity to dominate the world. And so you have speeches by senators in the United States Senate saying things like, the trade and commerce and the wealth of the world will be ours. America's entire approach to the world is in part explained by this concept of the open door. When a nation emerges and seeks to take control of significant aspects of the world, either militarily or through treaty, in World War I, for example, when Germany became so aggressive in Europe because it was so late to unify, and it was after its own spheres of influence, and it was after its own markets and its own dependable sources of raw materials, and it was behaving in a very aggressive way, to the point that when he was elected president in 1912, Woodrow Wilson sent his advisor, Colonel Edward House, to visit the capitals of Europe in order to explain America's foreign policy priorities and to assure them that nothing substantially different would occur under a Wilson administration. Edward House came back to the United States and reported to Woodrow Wilson that there was an undercurrent throughout Europe that was leaning towards the idea that Europe was headed to war, and that if war did break out, it would primarily be started by Germany. And that is indeed exactly what happened in 1914. And so consequently, during the war, once the United States made the decision that it had to get in, because we could not allow Germany and the Central Powers to win, because if Germany and the Central Powers dominated Europe, our access to Europe commercially would be affected. In other words, the open door in Europe would close if one nation became dominant on the continent of Europe. So consequently, the United States was absolutely required to use its influence in order to make sure that a relative balance of power existed on the continent of Europe. And what that balance of power meant, the way to define it, is not that everybody would have approximately the same power. Didn't mean that at all. It meant that there would be no disruption in the existing power balances as they existed on the continent of Europe. The only way that you could get the major powers to continue to support the idea of the open door is if each nation could rest assured that no other nation would become too dominant. The reality of the modern nation is that each nation would try to be the winner. Each nation would try to be the dominant, would be king. But since no nation can guarantee that it's going to win, its only priority is to make sure that nobody else does either. So it will engage in alliances and treaties in order to counterbalance nations that appear to be getting too strong. In the case of World War I, President Wilson and his administration recognized clearly that that Germany and the Central Powers have all of the military and strategic advantages in World War I, including the submarine. And for 3 years, the United States feels comfortable in staying out of the war but also in loaning munitions and money to the Allies to prosecute the war, on the belief that the Allies could win. But once Germany adopts unrestricted submarine warfare in 1917, Wilson begins to realize that Germany could actually win this thing, because they could absolutely use the submarine to shut off commercial access to many of the nations on the continent of Europe and force them to submit. Once Wilson recognized that, then he realized that the United States could not afford to stay out. In other words, we could stay out only as long as we were comfortable that the right guys would win. But once it became questionable whether, in fact, they could win without us, we had no choice but to go in. Again, going in principally to make sure that nobody won. Wilson's number one priority is to bring the war to an end before anybody wins it. Because if there's a winner on the continent of Europe, if there's one nation on the continent of Europe that's more powerful than anybody else, our dreams of the open door on the continent of Europe close. The same thing is true in Asia. Everything that we do with Japan throughout the 20th century is contingent on understanding the open door. We have reached the top of the hour, and I know Bob Kincaid is wondering whether I'm going to stop, because I'm just starting to get a little excited here. We'll pick up on this tomorrow. This is Bill O'Brien. You're listening to the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution. It's 6 p.m. in the East. Have a wonderful evening. Be safe.
Go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation cussing and discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Brand new week of broadcasting on the Horn. It is the 10th day of March, 2014. A little bit of a hint of spring going on outside. My goodness gracious, we expect it to get all the way up to 70 degrees Fahrenheit tomorrow. Shucks, that's nudism weather. We'll be back into naked radio before we know what hit us. It's about 2.5 minutes past the hour. This is the Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. That's where you'll find the daily assortment of news stories for your examination and delectation. That's where you will find, among other things, the entree to the chat room. It's free. It's easy. You're welcome to join in any time. The room is, folks are wandering in even now. Devin has joined in. Jan's there. Sparky's there. Tim's there. Waggy's there. I'm there. Why aren't you there? Come on in if you're listening live. I got to be honest, there's seldom anybody there when the program isn't live. But if you're listening live, come on into the HeadOnRadioNetwork.com chat room. You are certainly welcome to participate. You will also find our spiffy new media player at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. And you'll find, of course, the PayPal button. The PayPal button is how we keep everything going here. And thanks going out for the help we received over the course of the weekend. Thanks going out to our buddy Lib. And thanks going out to Reinhard. And thanks going out to to our buddy Dennis in Kentucky, with whom we will be mowing grass here before we even know what hit us. Thank you all very, very much. Because that's how we keep all of this going. Thank you so very much. Now, of course, on any given evening, we try to raise $150. We have an opportunity this evening to perhaps get a little bit ahead. Well, not really ahead, just get some daggum bills paid. The wolf is at the door. The wolf lives at the door most of the time until we kick the pooch off the porch periodically. And there are bills waiting to be paid. There are always bills waiting to be paid, but we have a little chance to wind up a little bit to the good. I don't know if you were listening to the beginning of Dr. Bill's program, but he told a delightful little story. It turns out he wasn't live this past Wednesday, and all I got was a note, and I didn't want to share it because I didn't know what the content exactly meant. He said, "Bob, I can't do the show this afternoon. I'm in a tizzy." And so you just hope everything's okay. And it turned out it was a very, very good tizzy because Dr. Bill had bought a couple of scratch-off tickets and hit a little hunk of money. You know, not PayPal or even Hot Lotto. No, nothing like that. But he announced at the beginning of his program that this evening he was going to kick $100 over toward the Horn in celebration of his good fortune. And he thought it would be a good thing to use it as a challenge to say, you know, so that anybody else who wants to join in can help him to get us to the point where we not only make an evening's fundraising goal, but maybe get a couple of dollars ahead. So Dr. Bill has a challenge out there. I told him to hold off until after the program was over. So he's got $100 that he will use to match the first $100 that comes in. And if you want to use the PayPal button, that's fine. Or if you want to use the traditional mail service route method, that's equally workable. Just maybe shoot me a note so that I can tell Boss Man Wayne that he doesn't have to wear his spider-proof gloves when he reaches into the mailbox. So we have that on the table. The what shall we call that? The Dr. Bill Lucky Day Monday, March 10th challenge. So that's what's going on there. This is, of course, like I said, Monday, and we know what Mondays are around here. And God knows I'm in total agreement with our buddy Marty, who asked the question early on today. Can we not, let me see if I can find the exact wording. I don't want to. Marty just asked earlier today about 2 o'clock my time. Can we just nominate the entire CPAC convention for Moran Monday? And I couldn't agree more. Lord God, I tell you what, you know what? I was just over to the CPAC, and you know what they got over there? The stupid. I mean, they's just swimming in it, Uncle Jed. Yeah. Lots of stupid. I mean, tons and tons and tons of stupid over the weekend. And I guess it was headlined, and I'm gonna do you a favor. And let's be honest, I'm doing myself a favor too. I am not going to run the audio of Godzilla from Wasilla, you know, Caribou Barbie, the half-baked Alaskan, Mussolini. I'm not going to run the audio of her rewriting Green Eggs and Ham. She has already been grandmothered out of Moran Monday contention anyway. She owns it. She owns Moran Monday. Every Monday when When Godzilla from Wasilla gets up and takes the first breath that she takes on any given day, she owns Moran Monday. This is kind of, every Moran Monday is kind of a runner-up Moran Monday as compared to anything that Mussolini might have previously done. But in this case, she was sickening. And I don't run this audio simply because, we run some pretty annoying audio sometimes around here, but this is the apex. I mean, this is the... what's that huge mountain on Mars that's bigger than any mountain on Earth? This is the vat of Moranness. So we're gonna take a powder on it, but suffice to say, she absolutely butchered green eggs and ham. Ruined it. Just disgusting. Marty noting, thank you, Bob, for not running audio of Palin reading her lines badly. Nicole Sandler made me suffer through it earlier. There ain't no reason to do it twice. I mean, there is a limit to all we got in common is our misery, and the least we can do is share it. It was awful. You know, Green Eggs and Ham is a children's tale of tolerance and curiosity. And that vicious, spiteful, ignorant, hateful, misanthrope. Really? Is that a pageant title? Can I be misanthrope? Made a complete mess of it and turned it into some sort of right-wing screed about not drilling for enough oil or something. So I suppose at this point we can say that I have somehow... dishonorable mention? Yeah. And by the way, I am still deeply affected by the passing of Bart Kopp, and I commend to you all a passage or a sort of valedictory that was penned by Tom Baggioni and published over at rawstory.com. You can find it simply by scrolling through the day's stories at headonradionetwork.com. Part and parcel of what we're doing, you know, by posting these stories and stuff is to give you a reason to come to the Horn website. Don't worry. We're not selling anything on the Horn website. We don't sell anything. We don't charge a fee for anything. That's kind of what makes this special, we think. But it's certainly beneficial the more people, the more people who use the Horn website, the more reason there is for the Horn website to get better. By the way, thanks very much going out early on to Sal. Sal just chipped in to help with Dr. Bill's Lucky Monday Challenge, and we are only needing another 9 folks at $10 a piece to meet Dr. Bill's challenge, and thank you very, very much. I want to take a moment before we jump into the Morans, and I have a Moran that you might find a bit surprising, a bit shocking for this program. And we'll get to that in a moment. But I want last night was the premiere, and not having cable around here, I didn't see it. But last night was the premiere of the new version of Cosmos with Neil deGrasse Tyson. And it's my understanding that that first episode also featured a lovely reminiscence of the importance
the importance of Carl Sagan and the original work he did in Cosmos. I mean, I remember, it's probably an unfair comparison, but I was, although not very particularly good at science, I've always loved it. And so I had a very good friend in high school, and I helped him with things like English, and he helped me with things like numbers. And I remember when the original Cosmos was on, the phone would ring as soon as the episode was over, and my buddy would be on the other line going, "Did you see that?" I was like, "Did you see that? Yeah!" It was pretty exciting. So in advance of the airing of this first episode, Neil deGrasse Tyson made an appearance over on CNN. And I just kind of want to offer this up as a sort of anti-Moran. An antidote to the Moranity. Because this is good. Neil deGrasse Tyson on CNN in advance of the first airing of episode one of his version of Cosmos. Let's see, when did this happen? CNN's reliable sources on Sunday. Sure. That's the best content CNN's had on that program in a while. All right, here we go.
A divided country where almost anything is fair game for snipers on both sides. But science? Shouldn't science be immune from politics? After all, it's called scientific fact for...
Now, wait just a damn minute. I think we've got a Moran nominee all by himself. This is Brian Stelter, who is the senior media correspondent for CNN. You'll note that he declares that, just right out, both sides do it, which is, of course, that disgusting urge toward duality that the for-profit media so eagerly embraces. Snipers from both sides. Gee, Brian Stelter, thanks for dragging out the eliminationist rhetoric. Golly, how could we ever have gotten through brunch without it?
We all know we live in a politically divided country where almost anything is fair game for snipers on both sides. But science? Shouldn't science be immune from politics? After all, it's called scientific fact for a reason. And yet there are millions of climate deniers, evolution deniers, vaccine deniers out there. Last year, in a speech on climate change, President Obama summed up the war on science this way.
I don't have much patience for anyone who denies that this challenge is real. We don't have time for a meeting of the Flat Earth Society.
Many Americans agree with him, but many other Americans see science as an attack on their values or on their religion or on what they believe to be true. Which brings me to my next guest. I am so excited he's here today. He may just be the man who can end the war on science. At least he's got a better chance than you or I have. He's Neil deGrasse Tyson, an astrophysicist and director of the Hayden Planetarium in New York. And tonight, Fox will be premiering his new series, Cosmos. Can you imagine a primetime network television show all about science? Pretty amazing. Neil, welcome to...
What, Edith? A network primetime television show all about science. Pretty amazing.
Only in the United States. Or Dumbassistan.
Pretty amazing.
Jesus. Skip a bit, brother.
The program.
Thanks for having me.
I want to talk all about Cosmos in a moment, but I first want to ask you, do you think there is a war on science the way I'm describing? And if so, how do you think we can broker a peace?
Our civilization is built on the innovations of scientists and technologists and engineers who have shaped everything that we so take for granted today. So some of the science deniers or science haters, these are people who are telling that to you while they're on their mobile phone. They say, "I don't like science. Science is bad. Oh, yeah, GPS just told us to go left. Yeah, okay." So I don't. So it's time for people to sort of sit back and reassess what role science has actually played in our lives. and know and learn how to embrace that going forward, because without it, we will just regress back into the cave.
Cosmos seems like an example of using television, using the media for good when it comes to science. I talked recently on this program about climate change and how there aren't two equal sides when it comes to climate change. And yet, sometimes the television and the media pretends it is that way. What responsibility do you think members of the media have to portray science correctly?
Yeah, I think the media has to sort of come out of this ethos that I think was in principle a good one, but it doesn't really apply in science. The ethos was whatever story you give, you have to give the opposing view, and then you could be viewed as balanced. In the clip that you showed of the president, you don't talk about the spherical Earth with NASA in it and then say, oh, now let's give equal time to the flat earthers. Plus, science is not there for you to cherry pick. You know, I said this once, and it's gotten a lot of internet play. I said the good thing about science is that it's true whether or not you believe in it. All right? I guess you can decide whether or not believe in it, but that doesn't change the reality of an emergent scientific truth.
Give me an example of how you on the show try to show the truth of science.
Well, everything is the latest scientific understandings of everything. So that's a given. That's just a given. The real messages of the show is, now that you see what the science is, how does it matter? How and why does it matter to you? In what context? So the science is contextualized, if you will. So, for example, one of the most stunning visuals is the cosmic calendar, where we take the 13.8 billion year history of the universe and lay it onto a football field sized year at a glance calendar. And the value of that is, we all know what a calendar is. We know how far into the year June is, or July. We have a sense of that. So if I say the Big Bang was January 1st, and today is December 31st, when was our galaxy formed, the Milky Way? That was formed on March 15th.
Let's actually play a clip from the calendar, because I love the special effects you use. Let's take a look.
No, let's don't. Let's watch that again on the radio. No, let's don't. But really, a sincere little golf clap to Neil deGrasse Tyson for simply saying that there is no flat earth position in response to the idea that the world is round or roundish. Marty, with a by the way, considering the reaction from the cons about a black Annie and a black Johnny Storm, has anyone out there noticed any right-wing racist tweets about Neil deGrasse Tyson hosting the new Cosmos in the place of the late Carl Sagan? Or did they do the whole, this is that evil science, so we won't watch? I don't know. I'm sure if you wanted to go wandering around the sewers of the right-wing corner of the Internet, you could find some, you know, maybe a one of those neo-Nazi sites, you could find it, sure, but why bother? thank you, Dr. John. Dr. John noting, yes, you nailed it. The fact that a primetime show about science is pretty amazing totally explains why so many Americans deny evolution, deny climate change, and so on. But even more, it explains why the media insists on validating morality. And also, from the Department of Way Too Easy, this from Dr. John, I do not like Palin on a boat. I do not like her in a moat. I do not like her faux hot glam. I do not like her Sam I Am. Hear, hear. Hear, hear. Jim noting via email, Cosmos Revisited, having watched Carl Sagan in a 13-part series beginning 13 September 80 through 21 December 80, I watched the entire series this weekend. I'll never forget the impact of the same. Sagan died in 1996, but his work lives on. So glad the program in the new form is back. Hear, hear, I agree. And, you know, the death of Carl Sagan, sometimes things fall into positions in our lives that make them unforgettable. And I just happen to know exactly where I was when I found out that Carl Sagan had died. I was sitting in the rather impersonal and big brick waiting area of the University of Alabama Birmingham Medical Center, reading the Birmingham News. And there was a piece in there about the passing of Carl Sagan. And it meant something because it was pretty obvious at that time that that my mother was going to pass away. Carl Sagan was, I think, 62 when he passed away. My mother was 72 when she passed. And a little bit later, we would go up and see her for 15 minutes or so, my father and I, as she laid there in intensive care with the medical marvels of science providing a tube down her throat to compel her to breathe, and they would compel her to breathe for another 6 months, or almost 6 months. So that's how I remember when Carl Sagan passed away. So just a little acknowledgement as the evening begins of the, you know, the work that's out there trying to make science real and accessible and maybe even inspiring. You know, Carl Sagan certainly inspired me. There are some things inspiration cannot do. Inspiration cannot make you, for instance, good at higher level math, but it can make you, it can inspire you to want to know what science is finding out. Expect a right wing hissy just any day now over information coming out of a place called Dartmoor in the UK, where it looks like quite possibly we may be running the effective dates of the Bronze Age backwards a little ways, which of course is going to present a problem, because if it gets run backwards much further, we're going to be past that creation date that Ken Ham and the weirdos who think that Adam and Eve rode a Tyrannosaurus Rex to a comfortable picnic spot where Adam and Eve knew, where Adam knew Eve and Eve knew Adam, and well, then they, right, and Cain and Abel and who the hell did they marry? It all transpired. Just, you know, sort of be on the lookout, as it were. So, yeah, that. And then, of course, like I said, morans everywhere. We will travel to Idaho Stan for our first nominee this evening. Our first nominee this Moran Monday is, and I have no idea how to pronounce this, is it Kootenai, 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 Jonesville, Kootenai? Any help from Idaho residents is more than welcome. County Sheriff Ben Wolfinger. Sheriff Wolfinger is all upset-like because he's a Christian and he's deeply offended by the Boy Scouts. Yeah. Why is he offended by the Boy Scouts? Because the Boy Scouts of America ended its ban on gay scouts, and he don't want none of them in his scout troop that he sponsors. See, Idaho has a crimes against nature statute, which arguably should have been wiped out a long time ago by the Supreme Court in its previous decisions, but Sheriff Ben Wolfinger is still clinging to it. He said having a gay scout violates Idaho's crimes against nature statute because it prohibits sodomy. Yeah, sodomy. And he also said that his Christian faith and reliance on biblical teachings led him to his decision. And that got me thinking about some biblical teachings. I thought we'd wander over to Genesis because they loved them biblical teachings from Genesis so very much. Let's go to Genesis chapter 19 since he referred to sodomy. Genesis chapter 19, verse 30. This is after the all-knowing, all-loving God of the universe has smote the living hell out of Sodom and Gomorrah and reduced them to a heap of burning rubble as if he, God himself, were Osama bin Laden or some sort of terrorist flying an airplane into a building. The sun was risen, this is verse 23, the sun was risen upon the earth when Lot entered into Zoar. Then the Lord rained upon Sodom and upon Gomorrah brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven, you know, because he loved them so much. And he overthrew those cities and all the plain and all the inhabitants of the cities and that which grew upon the ground. Then, of course, Lot's wife looks back and gets turned into a pillar of salt because God loves her too. And that would have consequences, because down in verse 30, we find out that old Lot, having had his wife turned into a pillar of salt, was all alone, except for his two daughters. Verse 30, and Lot went up out of Zoar and dwelt in the mountain, and his two daughters with him. Mama, it would have been helpful for Mama to be around here. Of course, you got to wonder what kind of family values they had when you see what transpires. And Lot went up out of Zoar and dwelt in the mountain and his two daughters with him, for he feared to dwell in Zoar, and he dwelt in a cave, he and his two daughters. This is not going to end well. And the firstborn said unto the younger, and the first one said to the second one there, I hope you're having fun, band on the run, band on the run, band on the run. And the county judge who held a grudge, never mind. And the firstborn said unto the younger, Our father is old, and there is not a man in the earth to come in unto us. And they let children read this. After the manner of all the earth, come, let us make our father drink wine.
Drink it, old man!
And we will lie with him, that we may preserve seed of our father. You're my daddy, you're my daddy, you're my daddy. And they made their father drink wine that night, and the firstborn went in and lay with her father, and he perceived not when she lay down nor when she arose. That must have been some fine, fine, fine Thunderbird, because he was passed right out. And it came to pass on the morrow, it was always coming to pass back then, that the firstborn said unto the younger, Behold, I lay yesternight. You know what? We've lost some great words over the years. That's one of them. Yesternight. Can we get that back into the coin of the realm, linguistically speaking? Because it's just handy. For instance, we could say, on yesternight's program. Isn't it great? Don't you love that? And it came to pass on the morrow that the firstborn said unto the younger, you'll notice these women don't even get names. They're just wombs with legs and apparently dirty minds. And it came to pass on the morrow that the firstborn said unto the younger, Behold, I lay yesternight with my father. Let us make him drink wine this night also, and go thou in and lie with him, that we may preserve seed of our father. And they made their father drink wine that night also.
Drink it again, old man!
And the younger arose and lay with him, and he perceived not when she lay down, nor when she arose. Now, either Lot was a lightweight, or I don't know. What's the biblical version of chloral hydrate? Maybe the Mickey Finn ought to be called the Lot Finn. Thus were both the daughters of Lot with child by their father. And that's verse 36. We've been six verses here. Six verses, two nights. They both get pregnant, so you got to figure, they're figuring that out about 4, 5, 6 weeks later. And that just gets glossed over for the two daughters of Lot who don't have any names because, well, why would you care? Maybe we can call them Palin and Bachman. Let's see what that does to the text. And Palin said unto Bachman, our father is old, and there is not a man in the earth to come unto us after the manner of all the earth. Which I guess there's a, that's sort of an ancient hearkening of birds do it, bees do it, even na-da-na-da with it, no, whatever. Thus were both the daughters of Lot with child by their father, and then 9 months. 9 months in which Lot, who we are not told, but I don't know, did they just keep him liquored up so that he wouldn't notice their little baby bumps? Who knows? Maybe they told him angels did it. That seems to work among those preliterate barbarians. Yeah, Dad, I'm all pregnant. Angels did it. Oh, well, praise be to God. Hey, Sarah. Yeah, Michelle. I told him the angels did it. And Palin bare a son and called his name Moab, the same is the father of the Moabites unto this day. And Bachman, she also bare a son, and called his name Ben-Ammi. Isn't that a scouring powder? Oh, well. The same is the father of the children of Ammon unto this day. Which was back then, not right now, because I think the Moabites and the Ammonites both got slaughtered down to the last human being back when never mind. Oh, Jesus. So there's your family values that inspired the sheriff of Hootenanny County, Idaho, to end his relationship with the Boy Scouts of America. Inspiring, isn't it? Just remember, anytime you hear some fundy say, family values, just refer them to Genesis 19, verse 30. Please make a note of it. I was thinking about the same thing. When Lot's daughters were getting him all liquored up, I won't speak for all the guys out there, but booze has a non-salutary effect on sexual performance. And the same thing occurred to Dr. John. He said, something doesn't ring true about this story. Recall your Shakespeare. From Macbeth, Act 2, Scene 3, the porter to Macduff. Drink provokes the desire, but it takes away the performance. Makes you wonder what else went on in Lot's tent, doesn't it? There's more of that stuff in that allegedly holy book that, oh. Kate with a note, thank you. Kootenai. First Nations in origin. I had a feeling. I just didn't know what to do with the N-A-I, because that looks kind of Greek. and that would be I, but Kootenai. And Kay says, thanks for not playing the Calliope intro. You're more than welcome, Kate. Luda pointing out that the Kootenai are a tribe of the Salish-speaking people in Montana, also known as the Flathead. Okay. I remember reference to them in my Lewis and Clark. Yeah. No, yeah, I don't care, Tim. You can dare me from now until the end of the program. I will not do my Godzilla from Wasilla voice. No, absolutely not. Yeah. Just can't make me. So, you know, there's a Moran nominee for you. The sheriff of Kootenai County, Idaho. Now the one that I said you might find a little bit surprising. This past weekend was not just CPAC. This past week saw the 33rd annual CERA Week Conference. C-E-R-A Week, W-E-E-K. Conference, CERA Week. Participants included BR Petrobras, Siemens, Chevron, on and on. And what it boils down to, CERAWeek describes itself as being, and this is a quote, the energy industry's preeminent gathering of industry leaders and government officials offering new ideas, insight, and discussions on major strategic issues facing the global energy industry. My, oh, my, doesn't that sound like a rollicking good time? Hey, whose water can we poison next? So they admit it. They get a bunch of hydrocarbon goons together, and they hobnob and what have you with a bunch of government people, so that the energy people can have greater influence over the government people, who are actually supposed to be working not for the hydrocarbon people, but for we, the people. Oops. Tickets to CERAWeek, there's a reason I wasn't there and you weren't there. Tickets to CERAWeek run somewhere around as much as $7,500 a pop. Well, one of the speakers to the plenary sessions was administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, Gina McCarthy. And of course, when you've risen that high in the government atmosphere. I mean, she's a bright, talented individual. And she knows how to give a speech, and she knows how to warm the crowd up to her. And the best way to warm the crowd up to you, especially when they may not be so crazy about you in the first place, is to tell them a funny that'll make them feel good about themselves, and understand that you really share their values. Oh, God. This is Gina McCarthy, who is administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency and has an affirmative duty to protect the environment. There is nothing in the charter of the Environmental Protection Agency saying that it is her job to protect the hydrocarbon industry. Mm-mm. No, I don't have the audio. But you can imagine it. It's a ballroom somewhere. They're all pretty much the same. Kind of like that ballroom at the Gaylord National Harbor or whatever, where they had CPAC that had 1,000 empty seats at the minority outreach panel. And so, you know, good afternoon. I'm Gina McCarthy. I'm the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency. Hold your applause. See, that's a laugh line because the hydrocarbon industry despises the Environmental Protection Agency because it kills jobs with its job-killing regulations, right? And I just wanted to let all of you know that I'm happy to be here today. I really enjoy being with all of you folks from the energy industry. I really enjoy hanging out with you guys more than I do with those environmentalists because, well, energy executives, and here's the quote, here's the Moran Monday nomination. Speaking of hydrocarbon industry insiders and lobbyists and hacks and flacks, she said, quote, comparing them to environmentalists, remember. Are you an environmentalist? I'm not. I'm a human rights advocate. Because environmentalist is a name that people like the people who go to CERAWeek gave to people who don't want to have their communities poisoned. Oh, they're environmentalists. They care more about birds, bugs, beetles, and butterflies than they do jobs. Jobs. You know, I really enjoy being with you energy executives more than I do with the environmentalists because energy people, well, quote, damn it, quote, as in she really said this, no funny voices, no monkeying around, quote, they dress better, less flip-flops. Well, damn, Gina, why don't you just call them dirty fucking hippies and get it over with? They dress better. Less flip-flops. Right, because, see, if you show up with some nice, shiny Brooks Brothers cap-toe Oxfords with a good leather sole and a nice rubber heel, by God, that denotes somebody who is well-heeled, ha-ha, enough to be taken seriously. Not some DFH in flip-flops. Really? How, and I found this over at dsmogblog.com, one of my favorite sites. How is a member, I mean, even misguided people who still call themselves environmentalists, how are we supposed to feel about the Environmental Protection Agency after a statement like that? Now, I'm sure, and I'm not trying to set up a straw man here, I am sure that the response is, well, it was just a joke. Isn't that a little bit like Mel Gibson hollering, well, I was drunk when I was hollering about the Jews, the Jews, the Jews. Don't we often tuck away some of our great truths inside humor? Just as surfeit of booze will not make you say things you wouldn't have said in the first place, but rather will make you be a little bit more truthful than you otherwise would have been because the inhibitions are down. That was what occurred to me. And, of course, there was a rousing chorus of hydrocarbon industry laughter. Because that's always funny. Laughing about those tree huggers, those DFHs who wear flip-flops and, you know, care about the planet when there's profit to be made. Hippies. I mean, I guess they're just gonna run the globe on love. And freeze to death in the dark. Oh, she was there for a purpose. And it was to try to provide more than a little bit of shoulder-rubbing camaraderie to the people who are responsible for poisoning probably more human beings than any other industry on the planet. This all took place, by the way, in Houston, which is damn near a Superfund toxic waste dump in the first place. She went on to tell them after the laughter had subsided about the DFHs and the tree huggers and the environmentalists and the people with the beards and the long hair and the flip-flops. She said, let me be clear about one thing. Conventional fuels like coal and natural gas are going to play a critical role in a diverse energy mix for years to come. We believe there are technologies that if we continue to invest will allow fossil fuels to be part of the mix as we look at the transition to a clean energy mix. And then those fossil fuels got higher billing than clean energy. Nick Akins is the CEO of American Electric Power, which owns Appalachian Power, which wants a $68 million rate increase from me and a whole bunch of other people here in West Virginia. He said at a press conference this past Thursday that the EPA has been, quote, saying the right things. I'm encouraged by the comments by the EPA, but at the same time, the proof is when the rule comes out. In order not to impact the economy and the reliability of the grid, we need to ensure this is done in a rational way. Oh, that's a knee slapper. That's a Moran Monday knee slapper, the reliability of the grid. Yeah, that grid whose wires are strung on toothpicks all over Appalachistan that blow down when an 80 mile an hour straight line wind comes through and knocks power out for 2 weeks in a whack. When meanwhile over in, say, Germany, they experience annual power outages on average that last minutes, not weeks. Oh, it's so much more fun talking to you, well-groomed hydrocarbon people, than it is talking to those environmentalists. Less flip-flops. Because I don't think that flip-flop in that sense means that environmentalists are constantly changing their position. You know, what they accused John Kerry of doing in the 2004 presidential election. No, this is actually referring to the fact that some people in the environmental community wear sandals. And apparently, your life is not worth protecting if you wear sandals. Now, call me crazy, but that seems a little bit arbitrary and capricious. And then Ernest Moniz got to speak. And he had... he had some advice this past Wednesday. for the oil industry. James Osborne at Dallas News Business wrote both of these stories. Ernest Moniz said, the industry could do a lot better job talking about the drivers for and what the implications would be for a country that still imports 5 million barrels of oil a day. He was, in essence, saying that the, and he's the energy secretary, that the oil industry hadn't made a good enough case on why the federal government should allow the export of domestic oil. See, that is why, see, all this stuff kind of ties together. That is why the Canadian tar sands oil that they want to bring through that giant tube of toxins, otherwise known as the Keystone XL pipeline, all the way down to the refineries in Houston, that's why it gets on a boat and goes to China. Domestic oil, James Osborne writes, domestic oil producers have been lobbying that the trade ban puts them at a competitive disadvantage to companies drilling abroad who can sell their oil at the higher-priced European benchmark. Well, at least Dr. Moniz didn't have anything to say about the DFHs and their flip-flops. There was a little bit of truth-telling from the industry itself, however. Chevron CEO John Watson this past Tuesday said U.S. energy policy is increasing income inequality.
The relatively wealthy can afford to pay for energy. Many of the energy policies we have in place promote income inequality.
There's probably no small amount of truth-telling in that. What happens, to the income inequality of someone who can no longer drink the water out of their well because their water got fracked up and poisoned? Well, they have to buy water after that, and that promotes income inequality. Ernest Moniz also wants the fracking industry to get with it, saying that they need to get out in front of the problems and do more to address concerns over the environmental impacts of unconventional exploration and production. Moniz said, it's evident that environmental issues related to unconventional production have in fact slowed development of resources in certain parts of the U.S., but not others. In other words, there are some places where people have managed to slow down fracking. He's probably talking about New York State. While other places are free to be routinely poisoned, like, say, West Virginia or Pennsylvania, or now, thanks to the help of the Sierra Club, Illinois. Jesus. They dress better. Plus flip-flops. Oh, my, oh, my. She is a funny one. And then coming from far-flung Afghanistan. Oh, dear God, I saw this story and I felt like crying. It comes via Agence France-Presse. It is from today. You'll find the story reposted over at headonradionetwork.com. Just going to read a little bit of it. Afghanistan promised Monday, promised, interesting word, to work with foreign investors, promise, foreign investors, oh dear, to ramp up mining, as the United States provided high-tech maps to help the war-torn nation exploit its natural wealth. Now, I don't want anybody to think that I'm some sort of a prophet with a tattered purple robe and moon and stars appliques on the sleeves and a busted magic eight ball from 30 years ago whose screen constantly reads, "Answer Hazy, ask again later," but I think I've been mentioning this for the past few weeks because it's kind of been on my mind. Afghanistan promised Monday to work with foreign investors to ramp up mining as the United States provided high-tech maps to help the war-torn nation expand.